We're going to be in 1 Chronicles, chapter 18, picking up where we left off. Rob will be kind enough to put it up there as well. one of those months. It's been really a busy season. How many of you guys have been with us for marriage group, marriage conference, any of those things? Okay, most of you folks at one time or another. And you've heard, like when one person comes home from work, to not be standing at the stairs to greet them with something, right? Well, that happened at my house. I thought you were in children's ministry tonight, honey. That happened at my house last night, but for good cause. This is the second week I've had issues with my heating. Well, no, let me correct that. It's been a year and a half I've had issues with my heating system. This is the second week since we've had it fixed that I've had continue to have issues with that. So it's like 150 degrees upstairs in my house. So I had a million things I had to take care of this morning. Then I figured with the help of YouTube, you know, forget calling my furnace guy, I'd tackle this. So needless to say, jumped in the shower just before service, got here. Whoever was the kind person that notified Ron to tell me my fly was down as I was walking in, thank you for that. So pray the Lord just clears our mind of the things of the world. Good lead in though. If you were with us last week, you remember in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 17, David was in that place where he was just sitting in his home. Just chilling out, relaxing. And if you look at the very first part of that chapter, he was in his home thinking of the Lord, just contemplating the Lord. And it occurred to him, I live in this incredible house made of cedar, which would have been luxurious back in that day. But I live in this incredible house of cedar, and the Lord lives in a tent. Or the Ark of the Covenant, the thing that represented the presence of the Lord, the throne of the Lord is in a tent. And that's messed up, David was thinking. That should be the other way around. God should have a house. So that's his desire, to build God a house. And you remember he called in Nathan the prophet, and Nathan, what do you think about this? And Nathan had seen, it wasn't just complete irresponsibility, but Nathan had seen that the hand of God was on everything that David did. So David, all that is in your heart, so be it. Do that thing. Except that wasn't the Lord's plan. Remember, Nathan then had to come back and say, oh, David, put on the brakes. I spoke too soon. You can't build the Lord a house. Your son will build the Lord a house, but God says he will build you a house. And he's blown away by that. Well, why God would do that, so undeserving to have a house built for him. But also, remember the other aspect of that. God didn't reveal to David at that time why he couldn't build him a house. We don't find out until, I think, chapter 22, which would have been way later, why David was a man of war. David had blood on his hands. So David couldn't build the house for the Lord. But his son Samuel ultimately would. And I don't know if you guys have ever been in that position in ministry or elsewhere where you really had a strong, sincere desire to do something, to serve God in some way, and it didn't work out. And or God said no. Or God said, yeah, this needs to happen, but you're not the guy or you're not the girl. And David could have responded to that. Could have been devastated, could have been discouraged, could have been depressed. We get to see tonight is kind of all about war in these chapters, but we get to see how David responded to that, kind of being told no by God, or at least no for what his desire was. So 1 Chronicles chapter 18 says, after that time, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines, subdued them, and took Gath and its towns from the hand of the Philistines. Then he defeated Moab, and the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. So just quickly on that, David's told to wait, and then he attacks the Philistines, goes out and attacks them, Do you remember the Philistines? Interesting, not a God-fearing, God-loving group of people, but it was a group of people that God often used in the discipline of Israel, used them as a rod of correction. It was an ongoing battle, ongoing war, often between Israel and the Philistines. They were located to the west, but God used them to discipline Israel multiple times. But here he subdued them, took Gath, and then he defeated Moab. And the Moabites, does that strike anybody as unusual that David would attack or David would go after the Moabites? Who's the most famous Moabitess that we would know? Ruth. And the relation to David, she was his grandmother, right? And if you remember, when David was fleeing from Saul, when he was in exile and he ran, there was actually a time where he went to the Moabites and he said, "Hey, I'm on the run. Will you guys protect? Will you guys care for my parents?" So there's some speculation. It's not written biblically. I'm not professing this as truth, but there's some speculation that the Moabites killed his parents or didn't kill for his parent or didn't protect his parents, and that's a reason why David defeated them at this time. Verse 3, it says, David defeated Hadadezer, king of Zobah, as far as Hamath, as he went out to establish his power by the river Euphrates. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 7,000 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. Also David hamstrung all the chariot horses, except that he spared enough of them for 100 chariots. Any horse lovers here? I'm not going to defend David in that, but he's told biblically not to multiply horses, not to multiply men, not to multiply wives, or not men, but chariots. So we see that 900 of these horses, he hamstrung them, would have disabled them so that they couldn't again be used. I wish Nick was here so he could explain what happens when you get a hamstrung. Snapped, but disabled them for war. They couldn't be used for war. He doesn't say that he killed them, though. You know. Yeah. So for that purpose, but they couldn't be captured again by the enemy and used for war. Bible does say that in the end we come back on horses, if that's any consolation. So David hamstrung all the chariot horses, except that he spared enough of them for 100 chariots. So kept the moderate amount of them, a modest amount. Verse 5 says, when the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. So the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And I want you to see that throughout all these battles, the real reason for David's success was not even his mighty men. His mighty men needed David. David needed his mighty men. But all throughout this, and we see it even later in this chapter, that it was because the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold, verse 7, that were on the servants of Hadadezer. I'll pick a pronunciation and stick with it eventually. And brought them to Jerusalem, and also Tibath from Chun, cities of Hadadezer. David brought a large amount of bronze, with which Solomon made the bronze sea, the pillars, and the articles of bronze. So I want you to get the idea of what's going on here, that David is going out for war. And as we'll see, the bounty of war that he collects, he dedicates all of that to the Lord. And this bronze and brass that he collected, Solomon used that in the building of the temple. So he goes out and conquers these different people. He gathers these riches, and it's all for, okay, God, you're not going to let me build you a house, but I'm going to do everything I can to contribute to that. I'm going to get the supplies. I'm going to get the men. I'm going to line up the place. I'm going to do all of these things in preparation. I'm going to come alongside my son and do all the work, lay the groundwork for this. And the Lord preserved David wherever he went. Something else with that, mindful of it, as I did a funeral yesterday morning. The Lord preserved David wherever he went. The Lord preserves you. The Lord still does that, has the ability to do that. You, I got to be careful how I say this, looking at some of our daredevils out there. But you are invincible. A lot of our teenagers think they're invincible and untouchable. And you really are, in a sense, in that God preserves you. We all have an appointed time to die and then the judgment. So those of you that fear flying, you know, that the people on that plane are the safest people in the world. God's got a plan for you, unless, of course, that's your day, then you're probably taking them all down. But God has a plan, and God had a plan for David throughout this. We'll see these incredible stories, and David was an amazing warrior, not just a planner of war, but hand-to-hand combat type of stuff. The Lord preserved him wherever he went. So he gets all these spoils of war, which Solomon later uses. Solomon made the bronze sea, the pillars, and the articles of bronze. Verse 9 says, "Now when Tou, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, he sent Hadoram, his son, to King David to greet him and to bless him, because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had been at war with Tou." So this guy was at war with this group of people, an ongoing battle. He couldn't defeat him. David comes in, wipes this guy out, and this king says, "Okay, I see how the Lord is with David, how Israel has annihilated them. I'm not going to let the same happen to me. I'm going to surrender and give him gifts and give him bounty and see if we get mercy." So it says, "And Hadadoram brought with him all kinds of articles of gold, silver, and bronze." Verse 11, "King David also dedicated these to the Lord." So David, at any time as king, could have taken this stuff upon himself. He's going out and collecting these spoils of war. But all of these things were dedicated to the Lord and used in preparation for the temple. "Along with the silver and gold that he had brought from all these nations, from Edom, from Moab, and from the people of Ammon, from the Philistines, and from Amalek." Verse 12, "Moreover, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, killed 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He also put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became David's servants." And again, the Lord preserved David wherever he went. So David reigned over all Israel and administered judgment and justice to all the people. And then we have kind of David's cabinet, David's leaders of the leaders, you know, his inner circle, his inner cabinet. Interesting, when you look at the life of Saul, we never get that picture of Saul. Saul was just kind of a one-man show as a leader, but David surrounded himself with good men. And then I love the last part of that, the last verse there in chapter 18. It says, "And David's sons were chief ministers at the king's side." David did well with that up until his notorious sin, and then we'll see how that changed David's life forever. So chapter 19, we'll get through some of this. "It happened after this that Nahash, the king of the people of Ammon, died, and his son reigned in his place. Then David said, 'I will show kindness to Hanan, the son of Nahash, because his father showed kindness to me.'" When David was in exile and on the run from Saul, he showed tremendous kindness to David. "So David sent messengers to comfort him concerning his father, and David's servants came to Hanan in the land of the people of Ammon to comfort him." So a couple of things. David was treated really well. This guy's son becomes king when he dies. David wants to reach out. And it says that not only did he feel something, not only was he saddened by this, but he did something. And I think oftentimes we feel bad for people, or we feel sorry for people, or we think of them, but we do nothing to demonstrate that. And also, I mentioned tonight, this is all about war, and David is this incredible warrior, and you think of being a man and all of that stuff. But David was all of those things that you would think about as a man, but also incredible sensitivity. You know, this man's father died, and David is upset by it, maybe shed tears over it, and decides that he's going to show kindness, not just feel bad, but he's actually going to do something. So he sends messengers to minister to this guy, to comfort him concerning his father's. It's something we are to do. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 11, it says, "Therefore comfort each other and edify or build up one another, just as you also are doing." And then I was reminded yesterday morning as I shared this at the funeral in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, it says, "Blessed be God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort which we ourselves are comforted by." So there are times when the Lord allows us to go through things for the purpose of us later comforting someone else. I think of a local pastor that just recently lost a child in the womb, and his wife had to deliver that baby, and then the next day, another family in their church went through that same thing. But it may not always be, notice that scripture again, it may not always be the same thing, right? You don't have to have experienced what that person has experienced or gone through the same tragedy. It says, "Who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble," just because we've experienced the comfort of God and can direct them to that. So David sends these guys, best of intentions, right? By everything that we read, he feels horrible. So he sends these guys to minister to him. And then we see the response in verse 3. It says, "And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun, 'Do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Did his servants not come to you to search and to overthrow and to spy out the land?'" So this guy gets some really bad counsel here. The one surrounding him, it's like, come on, are you buying this? You think David really sent these people here for this? No, they're spying out the land. They're going to get you. You ever have somebody question your intentions? Yeah? I look back there and I see the First Hope food ministry program that we have. And like everybody that's new to that questions, "No, wait a minute. This doesn't sound right. You're going to do that. I'm going to pay this amount and you're going to give me like three times that amount of food. And you guys don't get nothing?" So you usually almost every time give them like the first month free on that to let them see this isn't for our reward. We don't get anything out of it. But people are suspicious when it's not normal to do something because of the love of God. You know, in response to loving Jesus, you do something or serve somebody in that same way. And they're suspicious of that. It's not commonly seen in the world. And that's what's going on here. Come on, we're not buying this. Don't be set up. Don't fall for this. You think really he honors your father because he sent comforters to you? Now, they've come to search and overthrow and spy out the land. So David goes with the best of intentions, or sends these guys with the best of intentions, and they're not buying it. It says, "Therefore Hanun took David's servants, shaved them, and cut off their garments in the middle, at their buttocks." Yes, it does say that. That's why you should follow along. "And sent them away." Shaved off their beards, which is like the most dishonorable thing that you could have done in that culture. And besides cutting off the backs of their pants and exposing their buttocks. Humiliating, right? Humiliating, especially when they went with they went down there to minister to this guy. Right? It says that they went down to comfort him concerning his father, and the reward they get when they actually tried to do something good, didn't have to, but try to reach out and minister to this guy for his good, not for their own, cut off their garments in the middle, at their buttocks, and sent them away. How do you think you'd respond to that? Turn the other cheek, literally, right? I didn't plan that, sorry. How would you respond to that? How do you typically respond when you sincerely reach out and try to bless somebody and they question it? You know, I kind of get that. I get they're skeptical. But then when false accusations are made against you, or they cut off your beard, right? I want to cut off their whole head, not their, I mean, their hair, you know, or respond in a way, okay, that's what you give me, I'm going to come back with it. That's what we have to fight in our flesh. These guys reach out and they go back to David, they tell David. Then some went and told David, verse 5, about the men. And he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. That wasn't, I don't want to see you guys either. It was, okay, just stay there. Just wait. Wait till your beards grow back and then come on home. Seek no vengeance. I'm coming, bringing the cavalry. And he just says, wait, your beards will grow back. As the allegations that you made against you, it'll go away. It'll pass. Just wait. Don't retaliate. We see that modeled in Jesus, right? It's his beard's plucked out as he's at the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So just wait. Wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. Verse 6 says, when the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, Hanan and the people of Ammon sent out 1,000 talents of silver to hire for themselves chariots and horsemen from Mesopotamia. They went out and they hired mercenaries. They're like, this is bad. We've maybe gone a little too far. We've ticked off David. We need to go hire some hitmen. And that's what they did. Reach out to the surrounding people and hire these guys. They get them together. The people of Ammon gathered together from their cities. They came out to battle. Down to verse 8, it says, now when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men. Then the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array before the gate of the city, and the kings who had come were by themselves in the field. When Joab saw that the battle line was against him, before and behind, he chose some of Israel's best and put them in battle array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, and set themselves in battle array against the people of Ammon. So they're coming at him from all sides, right? The people of Ammon, the people of the Syrians, all of these mercenaries are attacking. Joab sees this. So he says, okay, I'm gonna take on this force. Tells his brother, you watch this side and prepare for that. And then look what he does in verse 12. It says, then he said, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will help you. Be of good courage and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. Brother, I'm fighting this battle. You fight that battle. If you get weary or you start to lose, I'm going to be right there at your back. And same for me. If this battle gets too strong, if the battle's too intense, I'm going to call out and I'm going to need help from you. That's our role with one another, guys. We see that even with Jesus sending out disciples in twos, that there would be another one there for when times get tough. If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will help you. So often, I think that's a desire of the enemy, is to divide the church, right? And we can apply it locally. We can apply it to this body because, you know, these folks fight with these folks and those folks fight, and that's terrible. But these folks fight with the Baptist church or the Episcopal church and all that mess and denominations, which is nonsense. The enemy's after us, just like these guys that went out with good intentions. Jesus said, don't be surprised if the world hates you. You know, they hated me first. They're obviously going to hate you. A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. So they go out and he says, you need to be my brother. You need to fight with me. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves at all times, But a brother is born for adversity. A brother is there for those times of battle. Verse from the wedding on Saturday, if you were there. Ecclesiastes 4 talks about two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. So that's the idea here that these guys have captured. Then he says, be of good courage. So understand, be of good courage, let us be strong. Those are not feelings. Let me not just feel courage, but it's a choice that we make to be courageous. Be of good courage, let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God. And then may the Lord do what is good in his sight. Do all that you can do, and then commit the rest to the Lord. And that's our role, guys. I don't know. Again, that same thing with David when he was told by God, you're not the guy, you can't build me a house. Could have been discouraged, could have been defeated. But in the same way, when you do all that you can do and things aren't happening like you think they should, there's a point in time where you got to realize that the results are up to God. You know, to make it personal, that's a comfort to me as a pastor, because I can only do what I can do. You know, if somebody wants to leave the church, you can't force them to come, you know. I mean, we can find out where they live and go knock on their door and all that. But you can just do what you can do. You know, you can only do so much, and then you need to commit the rest to the Lord. And that's what they've done. I'm going to cover your back, you cover mine, let's do this, let's do all that we can do. But then, may the Lord do what's good in his sight. The results are up to him. So Joab, verse 14, and the people who were with him drew near for the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. See that? They get all pumped up. This is going to be the biggest battle ever. They do the preparation, they do the planning, but then they commit it to the Lord. And as it turns out, it wasn't that big of a deal. The Lord went before them, the Lord went behind them, the Lord was there, and the people fled when they showed up. The fight wasn't as big as they thought it was going to be. Anybody ever have that happen? You get all geared up, wound up, intimidated, shook, ready to quit, committed to the Lord, and he fights the battle for you. So they flee. Verse 15, when the people of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fleeing, they also fled before Abishai, his brother, and entered the city. So Joab went to Jerusalem. Now when the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they sent messengers and brought the Syrians who were beyond the river. And David wipes out all those guys. I'm not going to read through all that. Skip down to verse 19. And when the servants of Hadadezer saw that they had defeated by Israel, they made peace with David and became his servants. So the Syrians were not willing to help the people of Ammon anymore, just by the witness that they saw of David doing this. Chapter 20, we'll get through this. Rob, we're not going to do chapter 21. So it happened in the spring of the year, at the time kings go out to battle. Isn't that interesting? In the spring of the year, the kings go out to battle. We have like baseball season, football season. This is the season for war. It makes sense. You know, when you think about it, war was very different then. Not going to go out and fight by horseback and whatever in the winter. And so it comes out to the spring of the year. That's the time for fighting. Time the kings go out to battle, that Joab led out the armed forces and ravaged the country of the people of Ammon and came and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem, and Joab defeated Rabbah and overthrew it. Anybody see danger in there, that verse? You know, it's interesting when you see... back in chapter 19, this stood out today. This should have been a warning to David. The battle's going there. Back in verse 8, it says, now when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men. And then they won. You know, it's like they needed the king. They needed the king and everybody in that battle, and then they won. But here we get David stayed at Jerusalem. And as I explained, 1 and 2 Chronicles is in many ways like a mirror to 1 and 2 Kings, but it doesn't talk about the 10 northern tribes, Israel, focuses on Judah, doesn't exploit or talk about the sin of David so much. But we know from having gone through that, David stayed at Jerusalem, and what happened? Goes out on the balcony, sees Bathsheba, and enters into what we would see as the worst sin of his life, right? He has sex with Bathsheba, gets her pregnant, sets her husband Uriah up to be killed. And then remember that whole thing? Then he hides his sin for a year. And he actually wrote a psalm during that time. I can't remember which one it was, 37 maybe. But he talks about how he's sick in his bones, just weary, and hid this sin. And he stayed back. He got out of the fight. And certainly we can understand as we read the chapters before this, and he's accumulated all this wealth. He's got all these soldiers, all these chariots now. David, you don't have to go out and do this anymore. You can get content, get complacent. Same thing can happen to us, guys. We can stop doing the things that were working for us. We can get out of the battle. We can stop going to fellowship. We can start going back to the old places, start hanging out with the old friends. We can take the armor off, as David did here in a literal sense. Take the armor off, and then when we do, the devil will attack. And that's exactly what happened to David. And we'll see as a result of that sin, remember after the hiding of it, Naaman the prophet comes to him and he says, I got to tell you about this guy, David. This guy has this little lamb, and this little lamb, he's got one little lamb, and it's like a pet in his house. He loves this little lamb. And this other guy slaughters it. And David hears that, and hearing that, it's kind of a minor sin compared to what David did, but he sees his sin in somebody else and he overreacts like crazy. He says, well, this guy shall be put to death. And then those words, David, you are the man. And then after that, we see David as a dad, knowing that he did this sin and God forgave him, but never was the same. And we'll see he didn't discipline his own boys, you know, because of this, because he was guilty of this. And anyways, this is the key. David stayed at Jerusalem, took off the armor, and he fell into sin. Joab defeated Rabbah and overthrew it. Then David took their king's crown from his head and found it to weigh a talent of gold. Actually, this is one of the sections of scripture that people talk about as being contradictory. Or Joab defeated Rabbah and overthrew it, but then David wears the crown. If you go back, as I mentioned in I think it's 2 Kings, this part, that explains more, tells a little bit more of the story. The battle was all but won, calls David in. David comes in and defeats the king. So that, an honorable thing, so that people wouldn't say that Joab overtook the land. So David took their king's crown from his head, found it to weigh a talent of gold, and there were precious stones in it, and it was set on David's head. Also, he brought out the spoil of the city in great abundance, and he brought out the people who were in it and put them to work with saws and with iron picks and with axes. Does anybody's Bible say anything different? I think most of the New Living, NIV, New King James, all that kind of read the same. When you actually look at the Hebrew, I think New American Standard says it as the Hebrew says it. That word, put them to work, actually means cut. Cut them. So, I don't know if something's lost in the translation here, but certainly an entirely different meaning. If you take the people and you make them slaves and make them work with saws, iron picks, or axes, or in the Hebrew, in the original language this was written in, he brought out the people who were in it and he cut them with saws, iron picks, and axes. complete devastation of that city. So David did to all the cities of the people of Ammon. Then David, with all the people, returned to Jerusalem. You know, the terrible thing, when you think about David as a warrior and going into hand-to-hand combat, and all of those things that the Lord was with him, David doesn't go out to war. He's out on the balcony, oversees this woman. We find out that he's safer in battle than he was on the balcony. David was also over 50 years old when that happened, when you look chronologically at that. So, man, I'd love to tell you when you're 30, the battle with lust is over. You know, but that is something that plagues our society, plagues the church. Pornography, that's something that we all need accountability for. You know, I encourage wives to ask your husbands, what's going on with that? What's, you know, what are you looking at on your computer? Men, like this, hey, if the battle gets tough, I'm going to be right there for you. Ask each other those tough questions of where you're at with that. Have you set up safeguards? Are you staying in the battle, keeping the armor on? Or have you got complacent with those things? So David's over 50 at that time. Verse 4 says, now it happened afterward that war broke out at Gezer with the Philistines, at which time, not even going to try it, killed Sippai, who was one of the sons of the giant, and they were subdued. So one of the sons of the giant, again, there was war with the Philistines, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, killed Lampi, the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. So David fought giants as a young man and is now still in that battle. A lot of times those giants that we battle just prepare us for giants later in our life. Again, there was war at Gath. There was a man of great stature with 24 fingers and toes, 6 on each hand and 6 on each foot. And he was also born to the giant. Real freak of nature. So when he defiled Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, killed him. These were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Real quick, I'm not going to do chapter 21. I was hoping to get through there, but there's a lot we have to tackle if we get into that. But one of the big things I want you to see, or maybe read in preparation for next Wednesday, is I mentioned David being on that balcony, and then David falling into sin of adultery, and then David murdering or setting up to have Uriah killed. And we think of those things as this huge, horrific sin in David's life, and it was. If I were to ask you what was the biggest sin in David's life, probably one of those two things would come up. But we'll see God measures by a different tool. And when we get into chapter 21, David insists, even after being counseled not to, on numbering his men. And that's a result of pride. And God sees that sin of pride as the biggest sin facing David as king here. So we'll dig into that. Let's pray.